What if? You can drive yourself crazy with those two simple words. What if you had left the house 5 minutes sooner or 5 minutes later? What if you had stayed in that night or gone out? So much of life is pure chance. And it can mean the difference between meeting the person of your dreams or the person of your nightmares. The most unnerving part? There's almost nothing you can do about it. I'm Christopher Wynn. This is Strange. In this episode, five people tell their true stories of an encounter with the strange. Mom turned private investigator Sheila Wysocki solves her friend's murder after a shocking twist. Former Hollywood special effects artist Russell Kuntz is stalked by a maniac on a lonely Austin road. Whitley Strieber, the best-selling author of The Hunger and Communion, faces unexplained forces in his Manhattan apartment. Music critic Scott Cantrell reveals the bizarre curse afflicting one of the world's most prestigious piano competitions. And Eli Sanders, the Pulitzer-winning writer and associate editor of the Stranger newspaper, comes full circle with the shooter who terrorized Eli's Seattle high school. Let's get started. Sheila Wysocki is a mom and private investigator who lives in Nashville. She's been interviewed by CNN's Anderson Cooper and profiled by People magazine. The case she's best known for is also, for her, the most personal one. In the 1980s, when she was a student at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Sheila's former roommate was raped and stabbed to death. Almost 30 years after the case went cold, Sheila helped solve it.
Angie Simota was a vivacious, outgoing, friendly, happy college girl, an engineering major and a computer science major. She had long brown hair, very full, very Texas. You know, back in the 80s, you had the big poofy hair. She had very expensive taste and very good taste, was able to coordinate things. She always looked good. We were roommates for our freshman year, and we started hanging out. So Texas OU weekend obviously was very big here, but also SMU was going to play Baylor, which was a big deal to Angie. So she was making plans to go to the game. It was obviously just a typical football weekend in Texas. I had met Russell before at a function. You know, it was just a party with several people, and I met him. He was very soft-spoken. I wasn't around him very much, just enough to have the thought that he was shy. And Angie met him, and immediately she's a great networker. And he was an architect, and she was in engineering, so he was a great connection. So she wanted his card, and he was older than we were. And he was probably, what, 3 or 4 years older than we were, but that was a big deal. He had a real job. That night, they scheduled to go out to bars and bar hopping. And there was this one bar called the Rio Room, which back then that was a big deal to go to because it was a private bar. You had to have a membership, and it was hard to get into. And so Angie's boyfriend at the time had a membership. That night, after they went to the bars, Angie dropped off Russell because he lived just a block down from her. And then Angie drove over to her boyfriend. The boyfriend was asleep. He was older also. He was a supervisor for a construction company. He didn't want to go out that night because he had to work the next morning. He was a responsible adult. So Angie went by his place to kind of, you know, tease him that he didn't get to go out. And so she knocked at the door. He opened it. They talked for a few minutes. And knowing Angie, I could just see her attitude and her vivaciousness and her teasing. She was probably kidding him and smiling at him and laughing that she had such a great time and he had to be an old fuddy-duddy to stay home. And maybe 10 minutes, she drove home. So her apartment was bought by her mom, and they chose an apartment that was second floor, well lit. It was on a busy street, so people could see it. It was ideal for a single young woman. Angie opened the door, walked in, shut the door, and probably right away there was a knock at the door. And the reason we know that is based on her clothing and where it was, and she hadn't undressed at that point. So the knock at the door, Angie opened the door. The person at the door was a beast of a human being who wanted to use her restroom and get a drink and use her telephone, I think. And a lot of people ask me this question about why did Angie let him in to her place? And knowing Angie, again, she was friendly, helpful. She would do anything for anybody. So this man came in because, of course, she's going to help somebody out. So this man turned to the left, and I believe he cased the apartment. And Angie went straight into the kitchen, picked up the phone, and called her boyfriend. Of course, she just left him. She was teasing him. He had gone back to sleep. So he picked up the phone very groggy. And she said, "Talk to me." She didn't say there was a man there. She didn't say there was a problem. What I believe, knowing her, she probably realized I made a mistake. So the man's walking around. While she was on the phone, her boyfriend heard a voice, and he said, "Who's there?" And she said, "A strange man." And then she says, "I gotta go." So what we know from the crime scene now, at that point, this man had picked up a butcher knife, and he proceeded to take Angie into her bedroom. Her boyfriend, on the other end, knew something was wrong but didn't know what. So he got into his truck. He kept trying to call her, and he was one of the few guys with his job that had a telephone in his truck. So he kept dialing her number all the way over there. When he approaches her apartment, she had a black Toyota Supra that was the coolest car back in the 80s, and it had her name on the license plate, Simoda. So obviously people knew the car. It was still at the front, at the bottom of the stairwell. He went upstairs and knocked at the door. Based on the evidence now, we believe that the man that was in the apartment covered Angie's mouth to keep her from screaming. And how we know that is because of the blood splatter. And at that moment, I think he covered her mouth and started stabbing her. Not only did he stab her, he was raping her at the time of death. This person was so brutal in his stabbings that he broke her spine, broke ribs, and when you see the crime scene photos, it looked like he had cut her heart out. It was so violent of a death. So the boyfriend was standing outside. He doesn't hear anything. He knocks. Then he goes to the front door and knocks. And then he drives around. Now, her car's still in the complex. And he doesn't see her. He immediately goes back, tries the door again, and nothing. While he was gone, I believe that's when the man decided to wash up, take the knife, take a towel, and leave. And he walked out. Nobody saw him. The boyfriend knocks at the front door, and he doesn't hear anything. And he's calling her name, and then he walks down to his truck and then dials her number so he can hear the phone ringing. He knows it works. Then he hung up and called. We didn't have 911 back then. You had to call the police station. The police arrive. They go upstairs. They tell the boyfriend to wait and while they look. And as soon as they walked in, it didn't take too many steps. The lead police officer said, "I found her." The crime scene happened, and a bunch of officers showed up, and they were trying to get leads on who was a possible suspect. Obviously, that night, since she had been out with Russell, he was the top of the list. The boyfriend had a starch white shirt on, no blood, no anything, but he also was a suspect initially. And then there were two other suspects, a boy that had a crush on her and her ex-boyfriend who had pulled a knife on her before. They started the investigation. With Russell, they told me they thought he did it. They flat out said, "This is our suspect. This is how we believe it happened. And I'm in my 20s, so I think that's what happened." I start asking Russell questions. I went to dinner with Russell, asked him questions. What was interesting looking back now is his story was very consistent. He had left town, went to Houston, came back, knew nothing about the crime, but it had been front news for, gosh, the whole weekend. The police didn't believe that he didn't know that that happened. They didn't believe, you know, that anybody could miss it. They've told me he did it. I believe he did it. We went to dinner. I'm sitting there thinking, I'm sitting next to this murderer. He tells the story. I repeat it to the police. And of course, again, back then, they didn't change their mind. That is who did it. That's who they thought did it. And they gave me the reasons why. You know, back in the 80s, we didn't have DNA, but we had blood typing and testing. Two of the suspects were ruled out with that, but Russell wasn't. Russell was living his life, and then he left the country. And so I'm thinking, this guy's never coming back. And they said he'll do it again. I met my husband soon after, and then we moved to Tennessee, the Nashville area. Lived my life, and then in 2004, it was 20 years after her death, and I started this Bible study. And I was doing the workbook. I'm laying on my bed, sitting there, and I am laying back, and I look up, and for probably 2 seconds, I saw Angie, and I thought, it's time. It happened so fast, no words, just it was time. So I picked up the phone immediately and called the Dallas police. And I called the detective who I initially knew, and no answer. They kind of blew me off, which, you know, they've got work to do. And they didn't have a cold case division then. And we lived in a guarded, gated community. And I was talking to one of the security guards saying, I'm not getting anywhere with this. And he said, well, why don't you become a PI? I'll sponsor you. And so I became a PI and he sponsored me. As an investigator, I thought they would open up all the records, hand over everything, and the skies would open and the stars would shine, and that did not happen. And finally, one day, this detective called me. I cannot tell you how great of a feeling. She actually read the file, she knew the case, and she took over. The first suspect she brought up all those years later was Russell Buchanan. One of the things that was done right that night, there were lots of things done right, but this one thing was done really right, was the autopsy. So the samples were very well preserved. The samples came in to Dallas and they sent it off for testing. And what I found out is, it's not easy to get DNA testing because it's expensive. There are a lot of rules and regulations. And then, gosh, it was a year later, there was a hit. I expected the detective to say it was Russell Buchanan. Her words were, "We got him." Immediately, I'm thinking Russell. And she said, "We got him. It's Donald Bess." And I said, "Who's that?" And she said that he had lived in Houston and he was up for the Texas OU weekend. He had a record. He was out from a 1977 rape the night that he killed Angie. He was on parole, and he is a 5-time serial rapist. We don't know if he had killed anybody else, and actually to this day, I don't know. He is right now on death row. I call him the Beast because there's no other, he is evil walking, and there's no other way to describe him. And I hate that he is the last person that Angie saw alive. I think the case changed my life for in many ways. I became a private investigator. I now know how important physical evidence is. You can't convict someone without physical evidence. I know that I know the process of what families go through and how gut-wrenching it is and how they have to fight for justice.
Did you have a moment, or have you had that moment where you think about Angie now that you played a role in helping to get justice for her, what you did say to her, what you would say to her?
Sorry.
It's okay.
I'm still very emotional about it. Yes, I have thought about it a lot. And I'd say we did it.
Sheila Wysocki is currently working on a new case in Texas that will be featured on ABC's 2020. Russell Kuntz is a digital effects artist with an enviable list of movie credits. He worked on Star Wars episodes 1-3, 2 installments of Harry Potter, the 3rd Jurassic Park, and the Tom Cruise spectacle War of the Worlds. And how's this for a geek love story? He was working for George Lucas's Industrial Light and Magic when he met his future wife, who worked at Skywalker Ranch. But before Russell went to Hollywood, he was just an ordinary college student in Austin. One night, he and a friend went out for a drive. It would turn into a frightening mistake. Here's Russell.
In the mid-80s, I went to University of Texas in Austin. My best friend, Eric, was going to University of Oklahoma. We both liked to ski, and one spring break, we decided to take one of the university ski trips to Breckenridge, Colorado. Eric drove down on Friday, and at that time I lived in a dorm called the Contessa. I think it's been torn down since. The Contessa decided to close and kick everybody out. So it was Friday night, and I couldn't get into my dorm. And we had limited funds, and we wanted to save all our money for partying and buying souvenirs in Colorado, so we were trying to figure out, what are we going to do? We didn't want to waste money on a hotel, so we decided, okay, we'll just sleep in my car. It wasn't very comfortable. It was a little Datsun 310 hatchback loaded with all our ski gear and luggage and stuff in the back. So we decided, okay, let's minimize the time, the hours we're going to spend sleeping in the car. So we went to see a movie. I can't remember what movie it was. It might have been Nightmare on Elm Street 2, but it was a scary movie. But that only killed a couple of hours. And so after that, it was like not even midnight yet. My friends and I in Austin used to like to drive out into the west part of Austin. There was a state park out there, Emalong Park, and there was a great road, 2222, that we used to love to drive on, that wound through the western part of Austin, through the hill country, out to this park. So we would go out there and just, it was a nice place to get out of town and just kind of hang out. if we went out there at night, it was super dark and you had an amazing view of the stars. So we would go out there different times a day, but it was a good place to go, get away from the city lights. So I said, okay, well, to kill some time, why don't we go out there? So we drove out there. We had gone out there biking a few times, and there was a radio tower. The roads in the park were paved, but there was a little gravel road that went up to this radio tower. And one time when we were out there, we discovered that there was a little ladder, and you could just climb the ladder up to the roof of a little service shed next to the antenna. And it was a good place to just get up above the trees and have a really unobscured view of the night sky. So I said, okay, this is a great place. We can go out there and just kill some time. We drove out there, parked the car, got out, and it was hot. You know, it was April, but it was still pretty warm in Austin. So we had our windows rolled down, didn't bother to lock the car. You know, we were out in the middle of nowhere. There was no one around. So we climbed up on the shed and just hung out there, lying down, looking up at the night sky. And I don't know, maybe half an hour at the most. And then we decided, okay, we're getting pretty tired. Let's head back to Austin and just try to sleep in the car. We climb back down, get into the car, and I'm getting ready to start the car, and Eric's looking around for something. He's like frantically looking all around under his seat and in his seat and on the floor. I said, what are you looking for? He was looking for his glasses. And he said, I left them right here on the dashboard. I know I put them on the dashboard before I got out. He got up, opened the door, was looking around thinking, you know, maybe they fell out on the ground when he got out. Couldn't find them. We didn't have a flashlight. All we had was the light from the dome light in the car. So we looked around, you know, made sure they weren't under the car, in the immediate area around the car too. And so then I started up the car. We turned on the headlights, and he wanted me to kind of swing the car around in a circle, you know, thinking there'd be a glint off the glasses and we'd find his glasses. He's walking kind of counterclockwise around the car, and I'm trying to turn and keep the light where he's looking, but there wasn't a lot of space. After a while, he kind of outpaced the headlights as they're swinging. Like when he was out of my headlight beam, because it was so dark out there, he just was gone. I couldn't really see him, except when he was in my headlight beams or right next to my door. I kind of got into a space where I had to almost do like a three-point turn to keep going. I look around and he's just gone. I don't see him anywhere. I started yelling. I didn't hear anything back. He didn't answer. I just kind of kept circling the car and trying to see into the darkness. Kept calling his name. No response. At this point, I thought, oh, he's messing with me. You know, we saw a scary movie. He's trying to freak me out. Then it continued, and so I started getting a little more concerned, and I thought, okay, well, I'm not going to get out of the car. It just seemed like something was telling me maybe I should stay in the car. And I didn't lock the doors or roll up the windows or anything, but I just stayed in the car. Finally, I kind of went down the hill a little bit, down the road, turned around, and came back up so that I could really flash the lights around in the area and see, get a clear view. I didn't see him anywhere. I just kept turning around, heading back down, like to head out. And I just kind of stopped because at this point, I really didn't know what to do. So I was sitting there kind of trying to figure out my next move. And then all of a sudden, the door flew open. He jumps in and he says, go, get the fuck out of here. So I just hit the gas. I didn't ask a lot of questions. We just kind of booked it out of there and got down on the paved road. I was still going pretty fast, and he started trying to tell me what had happened. He had gotten out of the car and was going around, and he was just looking down. He was just focused on the ground. About the time he first got out of my headlight beams, he heard a faint voice in the trees, in the bushes, saying, help me, help me. He didn't say anything to me about it. I'm not sure why, but he just instinctively went toward the voice. He went through, there were like some low weeds and kind of scrub and then live oak forest, maybe 10, 15 foot trees mostly. Once he got back away from the driveway, some guy jumped him, like jumped out of a tree and knocked him down. At that point, Eric was on the ground. This guy was kind of like beating him. He decided to play dead, which was probably a really smart move. He's lying there acting like he's been knocked unconscious. And the guy grabbed him by his ankles and dragged him deeper back into the woods. And I don't know how he didn't freak out at this point, but he kind of kept up the charade that he's unconscious. And the guy dropped him and then walked away from him back toward the car. And meanwhile, I'm out there going in circles. Eric opened his eyes a little bit and he could see the back of the guy's head, and he's crouched down and he's looking, basically strategizing how he's going to get me. Eric managed to quietly get up into kind of a crouching position, and so when he saw his opportunity, he just leaped up, charged the guy, got in a few punches, and ran. And that's when he got in the car with me. He told me all this. You know, I'm driving like a maniac back toward Austin. We were just super adrenalized. We got back to my dorm, and of course, there was no way we were going to go to sleep. We were really amped, so we just sat there for a while. Eventually, we kind of wound down, and I don't know if we slept at all, but we at least, you know, closed our eyes for a couple hours. And then in the morning, we got up and popped the hatchback, and we get all of our gear out of the car. And as I close the hatchback, I notice there's dust from the gravel road on the back of my glass, and there's like fingerprints in the dust going down the glass. So I must have been from the guy when we were on our way out after he jumped to the car and I took off. The guy must have run and tried to grab onto the back of the car. We put all that behind us. We had like a 25-hour bus ride to Colorado. When we came back, we called the Austin police, and they didn't really have much to say about it. They didn't really know what they could do at this point because a week had gone by, but they hadn't heard of anything else happening out there. So we decided, okay, let's go back out there during the day and see if we can find your glasses. And so we went out there and we looked all around, didn't find his glasses, didn't see any evidence of the guy or anything else. It just looked like woods and a driveway. But that was the last time any of us went out there at night.
Russell Coon still makes magic today, but in an entirely different context. He left the movie business after 2012 for the more stable world of computer-assisted product design. He now works in Portland for Nike. Whitley Strieber grew up in a prominent family in San Antonio, but he didn't want to be a lawyer like his father. He wanted to be a writer. He found success early on with his 1981 horror novel, The Hunger, which became a stylish cult film starring Catherine Deneuve, David Bowie, and Susan Sarandon. The book he co-authored about global warming became the 2004 summer blockbuster, The Day After Tomorrow. But Whitley is most famous for his own story. His 1987 memoir, Communion, A True Story, chronicles Whitley's abduction from his upstate New York cabin by what he calls non-human beings. The book became an international bestseller and was made into a movie starring Christopher Walken as Whitley. What I find most chilling about the story is this one sentence from Whitley. Quote, "I heard a softly robotic female voice repeating over and over, 'What can we do to help you stop screaming?'" Almost a decade before the events in Communion occurred, Whitley shared a small Manhattan apartment with his wife, Anne. A series of strange events there would foreshadow things to come.
I've had many strange things happen to me in my life. I've written a number of books about them. Most of them, though, have been ambiguous as to their origin. I've never been certain because of a lack of witness. But there is one group of incidents that took place back in the early 1970s that stands out, partly because of its strangeness, partly because of the sinister overtones, and partly because of the large number of witnesses. It involved three incidents. The first one took place in the little apartment in Manhattan that I was then sharing with my new wife, Anne. We were not married more than 2 years when this happened. We were in our living room. The stereo was turned on, but not connected to any radio station, and no record was playing. There were no CDs, of course, and certainly no digital music back in those days, and the stereo was fitted out with old-fashioned tubes. Suddenly, a voice came through it that said, "Hello, Whitley." A male voice, a young male voice. And I said, "Hello." The system had no microphone and no ability to record anything. The voice said, "How are you?" I said, "Who is this?" It was silent. I said, "What do you want?" It was still silent. Then it said, "I know where you live." I said, "Who is this? How can you be talking to us through the stereo?" There was a silence. Then it said, "I know something else about you." "What? What?" We never heard another word from it. I went so far as to get into contact with the Federal Communications Commission. They theorized that it had been radio interference from a passing taxi, but there was no possibility that there could have been any exchange in the conversation because our stereo wasn't equipped to transmit anything or pick up sounds from the surroundings. So we were left at a loss. A few days later, in the evening, we were returning to our apartment on foot from a visit to Doubleday's bookstore on Fifth Avenue. As we reached the corner of 9th and 55th, we noticed something strange happening in a little storefront. We had always called this the whore store, Anne and I. It was just a little storefront, a little glass storefront with a little bay window. And in it, there was a chair, and behind the chair, a curtain. And sometimes there would be a very uneasy-looking young woman sitting in the chair as if waiting for trade. And that's why we called it the whore store. But this time, things were very different. The chair was knocked over. The curtain was flapping back and forth wildly. You could see a man in a suit trying to come out, and these little dark blue figures would rush out from under the curtain and then back in again and push him in, and he would try to get out, and they would push him in again, again and again. We looked at this for a minute. At first, it seemed funny that the man, the blue dwarfs, the strange man desperately trying to escape. But then there came over us a feeling of such dread. We were two kids. We didn't know what to do. We finally hurried home, and I don't think we walked past that corner again for the entire time we lived in that area on West 55th Street. And then perhaps a week or so later, another strange event occurred. This one perhaps the most sinister and inexplicable of all. We were sitting in our living room. We didn't have a television, so we probably were listening to music or reading. It was quiet. It was evening. When we suddenly heard outside the apartment in the hallway a strange hissing sound. We listened. It came to the door, hesitated. We looked at each other. We were scared. It was no normal sound. And then it kept on, going down the stairway beside our apartment. We could hear it getting fainter and fainter. Anne said, "Don't open the door." She didn't need to tell me that. I wondered, though. Then a little while later, we heard a lot of voices, about 15 minutes later, in the building, coming up from below, people talking excitedly. So this time I did open the door. And on the wall was blood, smeared blood. It smeared down the hallway, across our door, down the stairs, as if somebody with an enormous amount of blood involved had been sliding their hands along the wall, covering it with blood. We ran downstairs. We were on the sixth floor, and floor after floor, it went on and on and on, all the way to the lobby, which was filled with people talking about it. And it ended, though, in the lobby. There was not another trace of it. No drips on the floor, nothing. Nobody had seen anything. Most of the people had heard the sound and eventually gotten curious and come out of their apartments. They'd called the police, and the police came, and there was no report at all of anything wrong. No suicides, no knifings, no murders, nothing. There was never a report. Eventually, the police released the evidence. The superintendent and his assistants were able to clean up the walls, and the incident was over. I don't know exactly why I relate these three incidents, but they all seemed in some way connected, that some strangeness was approaching us, slipping closer to us, entering our lives, and which stayed with us in the end for the rest of our lives.
Whitley Strieber's latest book is The Supernatural, A New Vision of the Unexplained, co-written with Jeffrey J. Kripal. Scott Cantrell is the former classical music critic of the Dallas Morning News. He's also written for the New York Times and numerous music magazines. This spring, the country was shocked by news of a double murder connected to the winner of the prestigious Van Cliburn International Piano Competition. According to Scott, what people were really talking about was the curse.
Fort Worth is home to the quadrennial Van Cliburn International Piano Competition, which is one of the most famous piano, indeed, music competitions in the world, in part because of the exposure from a series of television documentaries that have been done. And also, it's much prized by pianists because the competition gives them career management early on, which is often hard for young musicians to get. The competition has also had a series of tragedies in its first prize winners, to the extent that some people have talked about the Cliburn curse. Three in particular come to mind, and then one more recent that has occurred. Stephen de Groot, the South African who took the gold medal in 1977, had already seen his career slump a bit when, in 1985, as an amateur pilot, he crashed a small plane and suffered some major injuries from which he was not expected to recover. He did recover and took a teaching position at Texas Christian University, but later, on a visit home in South Africa, he was hospitalized and died from what was later revealed to be AIDS, apparently contracted from a bad blood transfusion during his recovery from the plane crash earlier. In 1989, the winner was Alexei Soltanov. He was a young 19-year-old mop top from the Soviet Union whose barn-burning performances certainly set the house on fire. But there was already controversy at the competition as to whether he had the maturity to take the gold medal and pursue a career. And indeed, in short order, there were more serious questions with the immaturity of his performances and indeed his personal life. Sadly, he was stricken by apparently a mild stroke in 1995 and then had a really debilitating one in 2001 that left his left arm and left leg paralyzed. So he could only play right-hand parts of some piano pieces from a wheelchair with his wife filling in left-hand parts. He then had apparently another really debilitating and indeed devastating stroke in July of 2005. He died in his sleep at age 35. The third great Cliburn tragedy happened as recently as December 2014 when the 1985 gold medalist José Figali was found dead of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Here was another case of a career that had exploded on the scene with performances with major orchestras, but had seemed to lose steam in later years. He taught at Texas Christian University and was, by all accounts, an inspirational teacher, but the suicide apparently was evidence of what friends later revealed to have been a long-standing struggle with depression. The most recent tragedy associated with Cliburn occurred when the winner of the last competition in 2013, Vadim Kolodenko, arrived at the home where his wife and two young daughters were staying. He and his wife had been estranged shortly before that, and he found the two young daughters dead and his wife with what later were revealed to be self-inflicted knife wounds. She was taken to the hospital for physical and psychological examination and was subsequently charged with capital murder. Concertgoers imagine a performing artist's life as a succession of glamorous concerts and standing ovations, but for every hour on the stage, many more hours are spent in practice rooms, working on music, learning new works, and trying to keep others in good shape for audiences who, conditioned by recordings, expect note-perfect performances. Competition juries, for their part, have been criticized, and often fairly, for misjudging talent and potential. But they can only evaluate performers at a certain point in time and guess at what their career prospects might be. Judges can't really know the human beings behind the fingerwork, their demons, or the unimaginable strokes of fate. Even the greatest virtuosity, the most sublime musicality, is no guarantee against tragedy.
You can read more of Scott Cantrell's work at dallasnews.com. Eli Sanders is the associate editor of The Stranger, Seattle's alternative arts and culture newspaper. Until recently, The Stranger was best known for its outspoken editorial director, the writer and gay activist Dan Savage. But Eli changed that in 2011 when he sat in a courtroom to hear a woman testify about witnessing the rape and murder of her partner, Teresa Butts. Eli's resulting story, titled The Bravest Woman in Seattle, won the 2012 Pulitzer Prize for Feature Writing. He had written the story over 3 days. As dark as that experience was, it wasn't the most chilling one Eli has had. No, that happened in his own high school. Here's Eli.
In 1995, I attended Seattle's Garfield High School. I was 17, a senior, an overachiever, editor of the student newspaper, white, wearer of outsized round glasses. On January 12th of that year, like the rest of the kids, I filed orderly into the gym for a Martin Luther King Day assembly, listened dutifully, applauded on cue. What I didn't know at the time was that somewhere else in the gym, a 15-year-old black freshman selling weed was getting, quote, jacked. Another black student, a junior named Hassan Coxum, was teasing him and apparently trying to steal his stash. The freshman left the assembly feeling humiliated and angry, and as the speakers talked of Dr. King's legacy of nonviolence and black liberation, He headed home, grabbed a 9mm semi-automatic handgun he had stolen from his grandfather, and headed back to Garfield to shoot a black man. By now it's noon on the day of the assembly. The entire student body, 1,500 students, is taking its lunch break. Kids are milling about the lunchroom, the hallways, the wide lawns and cement sidewalks. I'm hanging out on the second floor with my senior friends, having backed out on a promise to drive my little brother, a freshman at the time, somewhere cool and off campus for lunch. Hassan Coaxum, the student who allegedly stole the freshman's weed, is in the nearby first floor lunchroom. That's where the freshman, now armed, finds him. Here's what I later learned happened. The freshman walks up to Hassan, who sees the gun in his waistband. Hassan starts shouting about it, which starts everyone else in the room screaming. Hassan lunges at the freshman. They tussle. The freshman pistol whips Hassan, shouts at him never to mess with him again, and then tries to fire the gun at him at point-blank range. It jams. Hassan dashes out of the lunchroom, the shooter chasing him down the hall, out of the building, back into the building and into another hallway where pictures from the winter ball are being collected, firing 14 rounds along the way. A student named Rachel Thompson is shot in the knee. Hassan is shot in the behind. My little brother, having been left to find lunch on his own, was also in the front hallway at that moment. He ducked into a phone booth. The rest of the people in the hallway ran everywhere. On the floor above, I remember a wave of terrified students running up the stairs, washing over me, shouting about a gun. For some reason, my instinct was not to follow the wave, but to head down the stairs. Through a window in the door to the auditorium, I later saw Hassan lying face down, paramedics preparing to take him away. I saw pale-faced teachers trying to keep composure and order. Then I wandered. I didn't feel anything, didn't remember anything or anyone until a friend brought my shaken brother to me. Then I felt what had happened, felt the horror and the violation. I hugged my brother and then wrapped my arm around him and walked him out of the school to take him home. The armed freshman was arrested. He pleaded guilty on charges of first-degree attempted murder and first-degree assault, and ended up serving about 5 years in juvenile detention. Because he was sentenced as a juvenile, I'm not sharing his name. He says his original plan for dealing with Hassan hadn't actually been to shoot him or anyone else, but to issue an unmistakable warning. Get him to come with me, like to a bathroom. Do some TV shit, like put the gun in his mouth and make him strip down. Get my stuff back, take any money he had on him, then leave him buck naked inside the boys' bathroom as an example to everyone else. Don't fuck with me. And then it would be cool. How do I know this? Because he told me. 8 years after that horrific day, I tracked down the guy who shot two people at my high school because I wanted to hear his story. I wanted him to explain what happened. I wanted to know what had become of him since he got out of juvie. When I got him on the phone, he first asked if there was any money in talking. I told him no. He started talking anyway. He spoke of seeing other people shot in his neighborhood growing up. He spoke of wanting to have a gun to protect himself. He spoke of a hard-to-control anger, about a feeling of needing to get back at someone who he felt had humiliated him. In that, he was not so different from the many school shooters who, after him, would become much, much more well-known. The Columbine kids, whose crimes didn't come until 4 years later, were looking to punish people who'd picked on them, too. In fact, strip away the racial and urban components of what happened that day at Garfield High School, and what you find is a script identical to many of the school shootings we now keep in a grim mental catalog. A young, troubled boy, small in stature, victim of humiliation at the hands of bigger boys, gets hold of a family gun and comes to school to teach everyone a lesson. But back in 1995, the urban and racial components of the Garfield shooting kept people from realizing that this was part of something much bigger, something that shouldn't just be dismissed as black-on-black crime in an inner-city school. The Garfield shooter got out by his 21st birthday. He was 23 when I called. He told me he had kids and worked in sales and still lived in the Seattle region. Public records showed he hadn't been in trouble with the law since his release. The shooter told me he was sorry for what happened, especially for shooting Rachel, who, unlike Hassan, he considered, quote, innocent. I had to admit when I was locked up, They got it out of me, finally. I have anger problems, he told me. If somebody does something to me, I just get vindictive. Now, because of anger management, because of family, and just time, and dealing with the consequences and stuff, I learned how to deal with my anger. It was getting close to midnight, and though the Garfield shooter seemed eager to keep talking, I suggested we meet the next day to speak in person. I wanted to look into the face I never knew when I was at Garfield, the face of somebody who, in his 1995 yearbook picture, looks too young and too innocent to think of shooting a gun. We decided to meet at 1 p.m. the next day. He said he could pick me up and drive us somewhere. I agreed, and then I got nervous. This was the guy who shot up my high school, after all. I said I'd rather just meet him in a public place. It's cool, he told me. I'm not a predator. I apologized for being so obvious. He said not to worry about it. I asked him if he still wanted to meet me, and he said yes. But this was the last time I would ever speak to him. The next day I would stand in a parking lot waiting for a man who never arrived. A man I didn't know then, and still don't really know, but whose actions haunt those of us who were at Garfield that day. One of the last things he said to me on the phone was this. When you called me, guess what I was thinking about you? What? I asked him. I was thinking that you were one of Hassan's homeboys trying to come find me. That's the kind of life I live now.
You can read more of Eli Sanders' writing at thestranger.com. He's also written a new book based on this Pulitzer-winning story called While the City Slept, A Love Lost to Violence and a Young Man's Descent into Madness. Strange is produced by Christopher Wynn, that's me, and Jason Reimer, who also wrote our music. The show is mixed at Cigar Box Studios in Oak Cliff. Rob Wilson designed our logo. Special thanks goes out to Keith Reynolds with Spoke Media and John Lowe's. For more on Strange or to send me feedback and story suggestions, I'd love to hear them. Visit our website, strangepod.com. You'll also find links and exclusive photographs. And if you like the show, please take a moment to rate or review us on iTunes. It really does help others find us. Until next time, thanks for listening, and remember to keep it strange.